Glad to hear that it's working.
Yep, don't move it and put a little X on it, the ceiling grid, so you know where to put the antenna the next time.
Copy, I will do just that. Thanks again, this is KD2MNV.
KD2UPS, KD2IXP.
KD2IXP, good evening, John. KD2UPS, how you feeling?
Good, Richie. I was glad to get a hold of you. Wanted to wish you and yours a very merry and a very happy new year.
Well, thank you. I hope you and Joan had a good one as well. And things are going okay. So, antennas and rigs working out for you?
It's working great. I got a plan to snake some cable, some LMR 400 Ultraflex to the house and bring the antenna to the bedroom so that I can get to the radio easier than going downstairs. But I appreciate all your help, and you want a road?
Yep, heading home from Kentucky. I'm about probably a little less than an hour west of Wheeling, West Virginia at the moment. So hopefully I'll be done back in New York around 8 o'clock by the time we go all the way out east, get rid of both of these trailers and get back to the depot again. So, and then I work this week. I'm off the following week to get ready for winter field day, and I may do a one-day trip down to Delaware with some relatives to activate Delaware during a month-long CW event that's going on. I did that last year. It was a lot of fun. So I got to call them up and see if they'll be around.
That's great. Is the guy still meeting at the Eisenhower Park on Monday?
Yes, just not tomorrow because it's Martin Luther and the park will be closed. But we will be doing winter field day from that location on Saturday the 28th and Sunday the 29th. Probably get there sometime Saturday morning, start operating at 2 in the afternoon and operate for 24 hours until 2 in the afternoon on Sunday. So we have 3 stations on the air and you can stop by, put you on the air if you like. So no problem. I see we're getting close to that time. KTUPS.
That'd be great. Richie, you take care. Have a safe trip. And I'll talk to you when you get back, okay? KTUAXP.
Net. To the. Okay, 73 John. And I got to give you a call anyway to discuss some knife sharpening tutorials. So, but I'll be in touch with you about that. KTUPS.
You know how to find me. Not that difficult.
Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India. At this time, we begin the TechNet and LiveOc as we've done 1,634 times ago. This is going to be TechNet number 1,635. And you'll also be hearing Space Report number 235. TechNet began way back in September of 1982, 34 and a fraction years ago. It's a gathering of curious radio amateurs who want to know more about how their antennas work and how their transmitters work and how radio propagation works. Radio in general, wireless products. They want to know more about it, how to make it work better, how to troubleshoot. Let me drop this. So those are the usual subjects that are discussed. I have reason to believe tonight is going to be a little bit more than usual of an antenna night. George, KD2FIU, has been doing some experimental studies and probably actual changes of his WHAK, John Krause antenna. Steve, KD2HUC, has been doing some further study of what really is going on with the ground plane antenna, and he'd like to know more about the requirements for the ground plane radios. I'm pretty sure we'll be hearing from Joe to B2RYY, who's continuing a number of antenna experiments. Rich, K2UPS, by way of his portable operations, does a lot of antenna experimenting. W2CDO is another antenna maven. So we're going to be discussing antennas and those particular antennas tonight quite a bit when they sign in, as I'm pretty sure they will. Let me drop them. When you sign into the TechNet, you're going to give me your call letters, your name, because I'm so darn forgetful, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You do not need to sign in just because you're listening. After 34 years, 5,000 hours of TechNets, by now we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. Great big long list of people signing in saying we're listening, and signing in because they want their name on the list. That's not necessarily helpful for what we're really trying to do. The net itself is not super formal. Let me drop it. There are times from time when people get intimidated because they hear us discuss certain subjects at a pretty deep depth of technical information with fancy vocabulary and equations or whatever, and they're afraid that their particular question is too simple and inappropriate. As we've said often, the dumbest question is the one most deserving of an answer. So because you think you've got a simple question, don't let that these previous deep questions intimidate you. Go right ahead and ask your simple question. We don't have a highfalutin attitude that, your question doesn't come up to our level, we're not going to answer it. We don't do that kind of jazz. It says here, not everything you hear on the TechNet is 100% accurate. We make mistakes from time to time. Every engineer that you talk to, every scientist that you talk to, has a certain batting average. Nobody bats 1,000. We're never right all the time. A smarter engineer, a smarter technologist will recognize the fact he's going to occasionally make some mistakes. If he's pushing the state of the art and doing some new work, he doesn't have infinite knowledge, he's going to make some mistakes. And the smarter guy will laugh at his mistakes and learn from it and go on from there. Let me drop it. So you will hear mistakes on the TechNet from time to time. It is peer-reviewed material. By that I mean every one of the TechNets for the last 11 years have been recorded, and you can play them all back by going to Mike Perry's website, KC2NJI. You go to www.amateurradio.tangovictor. There you'll find the last 11 and a fraction years of TechNet recordings. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back those recordings. Some of the early ones are even cross-referenced and documented as to what subject is discussed during each 10 minutes of the TechNet. Throughout most of the last 34 years, the TechNet has run for 4 hours each Sunday night because there's enough people with enough questions and enough enthusiasm to go that long. If we make it much shorter, people complain, hey, we didn't have enough time to get to our particular question. Let me drop. So that was Mike number one, KC2NJI. Mike number two, K1MJN, has another supporting website at amateur radio, LimarkTechNet.com, LimarkTechNet.com, in which you'll find articles, equations, graphs, photographs, and so on that supports the TechNet. Okay, so this is going to be an antenna night, I can tell, because as simple as these antennas are, there's a lot of crazy details to them that doesn't first meet the eye. A simple ground plane antenna, a simple WHAK antenna, and some of the antennas that Joe RYY has been experimenting with. On the surface, they sound very simple. What's really going on below the surface, we'll get into a little bit of that tonight, and some of it might surprise you. So, at this time, people who do have a question or a comment for the net are going to sign in. They're going to give me the call letters, the name, and the word yes. K2RIW listening.
And can we, yes.
This is KC2 Queen Yankee.
Joe and
2FR2.
WYY Joe, yes.
2VBN, Far Rockaway, yes, yes, yes.
Okay, we heard EO with some doubles, QIW with some doubles, FIU, all by himself, George, Joe, W2RYY, Mr. VBN, and let's see, some of those doubles in the beginning. I'll go ahead and give you your call letters right now, K2RIW.
KD2HUC, Steve, and yes.
Yeah, I kind of thought Steve would be in there. HUC. I'm pretty sure he was doubling with Rich. Okay, so we've got Rich, Joe, George, Joe, number two. QIW is number one, and RIY is number two. Mr. VBN and Steve HUC. Have we missed anyone? Give me a call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
Yeah, I think HUC signed on before I did, so put him in the right spot.
WS2M, Paul with the space report, number 235.
And will that be 235 Alpha or Bravo? Paul, go ahead.
That would just be Alpha. Hopefully Alpha and Bravo is only once a year. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, we have more than enough to get going. So, Rich, N2EO, go right ahead, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Good evening to you, and good evening to everybody on the net. Dick, a little sad news and a little good news. I'm going to be moving. I'm working in upstate New York because price-wise is the best deal. I'm going into a mobile home, and I want to know how ham radio fares in Orange County. I'm looking at a town, maybe somebody knows about it, called Gardner, New York. Up there I can get a used mobile home and a piece of property for $57,000. And the mobile home is I'm looking at is 67 feet long, 12 feet wide, two beds, one bath, and a lot of good stuff. But anyway, that's the story, Dick. I contacted the Orange County Amateur Radio Corp. They haven't gotten back to me yet. I left a message. Back to net, N2EO.
Yeah, to try to evaluate a whole county as to whether or not it's a good radio location or not, I think it's a little bit difficult, Rich, because every county has got some high spots and some low spots. Choose a spot that's deep in a valley somewhere, and your ability to get a radio signal out of there, particularly on VHF frequencies, will be compromised somewhat. Choose the top of the mountain, you have a little bit more lightning, a lot better radio location. So a whole county is not easy to identify. But Garden, New York, in Orange County. Wonder if anyone out there has any specific information on that subject as to what the radio location is like. If so, give me your call letters. Even if you know a remote relative who went there and liked it or didn't like it, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. I was a little bit afraid there wouldn't be any answers to that one, Rich. It's a little bit too general a question. Total number of people who are there signing into the TechNet tonight is probably fairly small. When it comes to operating from a mobile home, the articles in QST Magazine over the last 100 years will give you a lot of information. A fair number of guys have operated from mobile homes very successfully. Some of them put up simple telescoping masts. Some of them used steel, the kind of bovine that's got their two great big longhorns. Guys who put longhorn-like antennas on mobile homes very successfully. So resonate first, then it will radiate. Altitude helps, but it's not absolutely in demand. The fact that the antenna might be physically small, that only raises the Q. It doesn't change the gain per se. You build a HF antenna, and you make it super small because you don't have a whole lot of real estate by using compacting techniques, winding coils and top hat capacitors and zigzagging and so on. That makes the antenna more narrow band, means your antenna tuner has to work harder when you tune away from the resonant frequency. Let me drop it. But a physically small antenna does not have a physically small amount of gain. You'd be amazed how many people fall into that trap. So because your antenna is going to be smaller, maybe, than the one you're using right now, doesn't mean it's going to be any lower in gain. So with proper experimentation and a little bit of research on what people have done with mobile homes and the property around the mobile home, I think you can make almost any communication work rather well, just as long as you're not buying a piece of property in the absolute bottom of the valley, Rich, N2EO. Keep us up to date. How soon do you think you're going to be doing that move, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Hopefully soon, but no later than midsummer. And maybe you give me a phone call. I think you still have my phone number. You would call me about something. I'll fill you in on things that necessarily I can't say over the radio. They're not for the radio. And certainly not for iMark. But I will be making a move. I think there are other things that are good, too. There's wild turkey. There's deer. There are lakes and streams in most of these places. I don't want to go into a mobile home park. The average rent is $850 a month. And a lot of... So I'd rather go upstate, buy my own property, live a mobile home. That's what I'm doing, Dick. Give me a phone call or shoot me an email, I'll give it to you.
Okay, Rich, good luck with that project. And moving is kind of exciting sometimes. Joe is our next person on the list, KCQQYW. What'd you like to talk about tonight, Joe? We'll discuss anything except antennas. That's a joke. Joe's got it, K2RIW.
Roger, roger. Yeah, I was outside in the porch setting up my scanner antenna, and one of my neighbors came up to me. He said to me, like, are you a spy? Some kind of spy or something? So, yeah, I just laughed it off. So, all right, so let me get to my question. My question to you is, I'm not sure if it's every year, once a year, that the Earth is moving closer to the Sun, or the Sun is moving closer to the Earth. So my question to you guys is, will that affect the HF frequencies? Back to you, Dick.
I think the answer is almost no, as I see it, Joe. Somewhere around January 3rd or so, January 6th, is when the Earth is closest to the Sun. The Earth goes around the Sun with a very slightly elliptical orbit, so that's when we're the closest. But the elliptical orbit of the Sun, Earth around the Sun, is so close to a circle that change in distance is very minor. Whether or not the sun's shining on the northern hemisphere because it's our summer, or the southern hemisphere because it's their summer in December, that makes a huge difference in the way the ionosphere behaves. But the closeness of the sun, I think, is an extremely minor factor. Other than that, the way our magnetic field behaves and the way our the ultraviolet rays from the sun excite the ionosphere, and how dense is the ionosphere, That's all a function of the sunspot cycle. So sunspot cycle is a big factor. Summer and northern sun, because of summer and winter, that's a big factor. The gray zone, because of night and day, that's a big factor. So the one you've mentioned is probably, of all of the factors, is probably way down at the bottom of the list, I believe, Joe. KC2QIW, K2IW, the TechNet. Good question.
Hey, Roger, Roger. So I'll get back to you next week about the spy. I guess some of my neighbors might think I'm some kind of Russian spy because I have like so many antennas in the backyard. And I came outside today, and he was on his cell phone, probably talking about my antennas. So maybe he's thinking that I'm listening to his cell phone conversations and whatnot. So maybe that's why he asked me if I'm some kind of spy. So maybe. Right? So that's funny. All right, so I'll send it back to the net, and thank you guys.
Yeah, up till now, I haven't heard of the people in Harrison, New York, where you live, are that sensitive. Up till now, the people who are most sensitive I know about are the people in Bayville, Long Island, which is part of Oyster Bay Township. There, they want all antennas removed from their town. That includes fire, police, cell phone, ambulance services. They want all of those antennas out. And I was visiting my relative in Bayville one day a couple of years ago, pulled into a garage to get some gasoline, and the mag mount antenna sticking out of my top of my car made a person at the gas station who was also getting gasoline walk over to me saying, "Are you in government service? Why is that antenna on your town, on your car, and why are you in our town?" I tried to explain it's a ham radio antenna, and I can tell they weren't understanding of that. So that town, they're trying to drastically, from time to time, they vote their mayor out of service. Victoria Siegel, among other people, have been voted out of mayoral service in that village because she allowed cell phone antennas to be put on the highest place in the town, the water tower. They want all those antennas put in somebody else's town. And what it does to the people in that town, they don't care about. Just get them out of our town. They're strongly misunderstanding RF radiation. That emotional word, radiation. I wish the scientists, when they were studying it, had called it RF signaling, RF transmission. The word radiation, when nuclear radiation came along, caused an improper association. Radio is your friend. And unless you do something really crazy, like transmit a kilowatt of an into a very small antenna that's only a foot away from your head, that would be pushing your luck. But other than that, very difficult with radio energy to get your
repeater timeout
to get yourself in trouble with the amount of radio signal strength that we put out. So good luck with that project, Joe. The next person on our list was George, KD2FIU. And George, I think we're going to be discussing the WHJK antenna. I got a lot of comments on that particular subject since you last brought it up to us. KD2FIU, K2RIW. Go ahead, George.
Thank you, Dick. Last time we spoke, about 2 weeks ago, I was asking for a recommendation on the length of the phasing stubs. And since then, I researched a lot of information about that antenna, which was actually the protocol for a lot of antennas that came out after it, came across a lot of projects within the 8JK, the stack dipoles, the lazy H, all of their different patterns of radiation, their feed point, their impedances, whether they were multi-band or single band. Let me drop. Types of feed line, types of impedance at feed point, and I had to realize that I wanted to narrow down my specific application on what I wanted to use it for, whether it was multi-band, single band, how much room I had,
and there was a lot of things. So far, I've gotten to the point where I'm going to use it as a broad inverted V at 135 degrees for single band 10 meter operation as my first experiment, because that's the room I have in my attic. And I'm going to make it out of twin lead to give it a little bit of more broad band length, broad bandwidth, and to increase the impedance a bit, understanding the impedance, high impedance problems. Let me drop. A lot of people had with the designs of this. And from there, I'm going to experiment with coiling different capacitive balance, 4-to-1 up to 6-to-1, to bring that down to a low loss coaxial from the high point that I want to do it. And by the way, the objective here is for small space attic 10 meter directivity with no 90 and 180 right and left, bi-directional, achieving up to maybe 7 dBi. Thank you, Dick.
Yeah, the WAJK antenna by Dr. John Krause of Ohio University. Dr. John Krause is the inventor of the helical antenna, the inventor of the so-called WAJK, the publisher of a lot of very good books called Antennas, which is in 3 editions. It's also got a beautiful book on radio astronomy. He set up a major radio telescope in Miamisburg, Ohio, which I visited. Airborne Instruments Laboratory supplied some of the low-noise amplifiers for that 1,420-megacycle major radio telescope, the second one he put on that property. So, antenna-wise, a very pivotal person, now a silent key. But the so-called WAJK antenna, let me drop it. The way it usually looks is it's a pair of approximately halfway dipoles that are broadside to each other. You could set up the wire of the dipoles so that the wire is north-south, and the two dipoles are now broadside spaced east-west of each other. In my example, each dipole is approximately half wavelength long. There is something like twin lead between the two dipoles, and depending on which design you choose, the two dipoles being broadside to each other can be anything from even less than an eighth of a wavelength spacing all the way up to a half wavelength spacing. There is something like open wire transmission line going from the center of dipole number one to dipole number two. How long you make that transmission line and where you connect your feed point, whether your feed point is closest to the eastern dipole, closest to the western dipole, or midway between the two. There's various advantages and disadvantages as to how you do that. You could, if you want to, make the whole setup out of two continuous pieces of wire. One long piece of wire could be the northern half of the most eastern dipole down to the twin lead between the two dipoles, and then continuing to the upper half of the most western dipole. That's one piece of wire. And the bottom half would be another piece of wire. So you could make the WAJK with no junctions at all except for where you put your transmission line going into it. And whether or not the dipoles are electrically less than half wave, electrically shortened, with loading coils, top hat capacitors, let me drop. Whether the individual dipoles are made as inverted Vs or Vs or as arrows, you could make them as each dipole could be slanted parallel to the earth so that they look like arrows. And so there's a number of television aerials that operate that way. So there's a lot of variations going on here. How thick is the wire? What's the spacing of the dipoles? What's the length of the transmission line between the dipoles? Where you feed it? Where you feed it can make a significant difference in impedance. And at first you think that's going to be significant. With modern day antenna tuners, that is not significant. If you're feeding it with open wire line, the exact impedance of the antenna almost doesn't matter because your antenna tuner will take care of it. In the case of open wire line, which is often made with big spacing at 600 ohms, sometimes 450 ohms, sometimes 300 ohms, the magic of open wire line is that the impedance is roughly 10 times higher than you would use with coax. That means the voltage is higher and the current is lower. You have a lot less I squared R ohmic loss of the wire because the current is roughly 1/10. Let me drop. And 97% of the dielectric material between your two conductors of an open wire transmission line, 97% of that is air, the lowest loss stuff in the world. So for a whole bunch of factors, open wire transmission line is by far the lowest stuff, and it's inexpensive. You got to obey a couple of crazy rules in order to get full performance out of it. Don't make any sharp turns, don't have any nearby metal between the two wires, and even that can tolerate if you do it in a slow taper. But by coax, coaxial transmission lines are very popular because they are so well shielded. However, the coax at 1/10 the impedance of an open wire transmission line is 10 times higher current. Therefore, the ohmic loss of the wire is a lot higher. Let me drop. The spacing between center conductor and shield and coax cable is such an extremely small distance, usually less than a centimeter. You have a huge amount of volts per meter or volts per centimeter. Therefore, you get a lot of dielectric loss in the coax, unless it's a super high efficiency dielectric material. So for a bunch of reasons, coax cable, for the same amount of weight in dollars, has got a lot more loss than open wire transmission line. So the HAK antenna usually is fed with open wire transmission line. The exact impedance doesn't matter because open wire transmission line running in a 10 to 1 standing wave ratio still has very little loss. And if your antenna tuner will match that, no problem. So now, the variables involved, let me drop. The variables involved of your particular HAK is, did you make it as an inverted V or parallel to the surface of the Earth? Did you make it like arrows? Did you make the wire less than half wave or longer than half wave in the resonance of each individual dipole? The phasing between the two dipoles is what determines the pattern, whether it be a figure eight pattern, nearly omnidirectional, or have a lot of directivity and a good front-to-back ratio. That's a function of the amplitude and the phasing of the individual dipoles. You would think at first that you're changing the phasing of the dipoles by changing the length of the twin lead that goes between the dipoles. That's one of the variables. As you make a dipole longer, it becomes more inductive. Therefore, the current that flows in it is more lagging, so you can have a significant amount of phase shift of the current in one of the dipoles because of the length you've made of that dipole, even though you think you've only controlled the phasing by way of the length of the twin lead between the dipoles. By way of computer modeling, you can study all of these parameters: diameter of wire, length of the dipoles, spacing between the dipoles, length of the feed line between them, the impedance of the feed line between them, where you connect the transmission line. You got this simple antenna of inexpensive materials. Let me drop. This simple antenna of inexpensive materials has a whole lot of variables, and by way of computer modeling, you can do a very good job of studying that. And another one of the variables is how many feet above the ground. And it's usually called a lazy H because top view, it looks like an H, and everything is parallel to the Earth. It doesn't have to be. You could, if you want to, make this a vertical stack if you've got enough property and enough altitude. You could make the HJK antenna stand up on end where one dipole is above the other, and there's certain advantages of doing that. And so you could make it radiate broadside as long as you make the current flowing into each dipole in phase. And so that's another thing that could give you control of the vertical angle of radiation. So as you read more and more of these articles, realize how many variables you got, and realize how much computer modeling you can do. You can have a lot of fun with this antenna. And so this is a significant project that could keep you off the streets for many months to come, as I see it, George. KD2FIU, how's the progress? KD2RIW, you got it, George.
Thank you, Dick, for doing some research. In parallel, I did not I don't think I achieved as much research as you did. However, Lazy H was one of the variations of Dr. Krause's original flat-top arrays. And I started with the modeling of the original flat-top array, going with monoband, and agreed. You could, if you offset the length of the feeding stubs out of phase, if you offset the length, you begin to change the pattern, and if you pull it a little bit to one side, you're going to actually start to create a cardioid pattern, unidirectional, and that's because I learned over here that the length of the phasing stubs actually become part of the length of the element. Let me drop. This was not the way I was thinking 2 weeks ago. I thought the phasing stub was the phasing stub. It actually becomes part of the length of the radiating element. Now, if there's also different formulas going for whether you want it as a multi-band or a single-band antenna, and I was trying to achieve single-band, so I'm going to go with, my project is to go with precisely equal-length phasing lines in between, one out of phase, of course, and with the different patterns of whether it was complete flat-top dipole, I've seen patterns with 1/8 horizontal, 1/8 vertical for each of the dipoles, must be precise. But I was going to go for a 135-degree inverted V for an attic model because I can drop it down from the center of the right angle of the roof. I have that kind of height. I'll come down to 135 degrees, present my angle like that. Let me drop. And with that, do it with a twin lead to get some broadband and to increase the impedance at the feed point. But what you've handed me is that you've seen so many more examples of this, because and as you mentioned, it was brought into television antennas later on. Extremely, extremely valuable information to put together for any ham radio operator out there is to understand the basic concept of what is going on with this and how many different antennas you can build from it. Feeding it with twin lead, not the phasing line. The phasing line has to be twin lead. I'm going to build my elements out of twin lead also to get a broader bandwidth on the single frequencies that I work, because I'm not going to work a multi-band antenna. Let me drop. If you're working a multi-band antenna and you're going to build it from this, you're going to be off of a specific frequency, like most multi-band or almost all of multi-band antennas are. And with that, you've got to feed away with either twin lead or window line 450 ohms, and you got to feed away in multiples of half wavelengths before you convert with your loading coils. So with that, I decided to go with a single band, 10 meter, that's the space I have, and it's all starting to come together. This is great information that we're working with, and I really appreciate your research, and hopefully I'm conveying something to the people on the net tonight. Over to you, Rich.
Very fine, George. This seemingly simple antenna made out of rather inexpensive materials has a whole lot of variables to it. The television aerial called a double conical antenna is closely related to the WHAK. There's a vertical stacking of WHAK-like structure. By the way, the in individual dipoles. You're going to be building them out of twin lead to get a little bit more broad bandwidth, again, using inexpensive materials. And there's something else you can do that I haven't seen, but put this in the back of your mind. Each half of the dipole doesn't have to be a straight single wire or a straight single piece of twin lead. Each half of a dipole could be diamond-shaped, a pair of wires that spread out so that they got a greater spacing near the tips and they come to an apex at the feed point. And there's a whole section of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, Chapter 4, about making you're building a skeleton equivalent of a bow tie antenna. Each half of a dipole, if you made them out of sheet metal, they would be bow ties. But you can make them out of skeleton wires, and whether or not you put another wire across the tips and completely close the triangles is your choice. But that is a beautiful broadbanding technique. So by using very little extra wire, doubling up each dipole, and the wires of each half of the dipole spread out toward the tips, which, you know, in your attic, when you're mounting this as an inverted V, having some extra strings to support this, going to the rafters, that's very easy to do with the all the support materials you've got nearby. Let me drop it. That's another technique. The bow tie or skeleton bow tie-like antennas will definitely increase the bandwidth, and it's worth fighting for, and it's worth modeling. So your problem, as I see it, George, is that there's a darn many variables involved to finally settle down on which one you're going to build, or which pair, or which two or three of these you're going to build and experiment with. It's going to keep you off the streets for a lot of time to come. The exact feed impedance doesn't matter because your antenna tune is going to take care of that. Open wire line is so forgiving of high standing wave ratios that doesn't matter. It's not going to create any real insertion loss or extra radiation of the open wire transmission line that you're going to feed it with. So, good luck with that project. I'll pass it back to you for any final fills you might need on some of the things I just said, George. KD2FIU, K2IW in the TechNet.
Comment?
Yeah, Dick, thank you. Excellent tip on the bow tie design for the elements. And, it's something I know I'm going to be playing with and enjoying playing with to see what the results are. But that was a great tip that you just gave me on the bow tie elements. I drew it as you were talking to me, and I could just see it. I could just see what the benefit would be. Thank you very much, Dick. K2RIW and Annette. KD2FIU, and I'll let it go. Thank you.
Yeah, those V-shaped pieces of wire will fool the RF wave into thinking you've got a great big wide piece of sheet metal there, even though you don't. Somebody said comment. Could be K2UPS, I'm not sure. Over to Mr. Comment, wait for the beeps. K2RIW in the TechNet.
At the KTVS mobile, my comment was using the open wire line. I was going to ask him what he was going to use or make his own, and I heard him mention for he can fit the own window line. But there's a really nice product out there called Ladder Snap. It's made by a company called 73CNC, 73CharlieNovemberCharlie.com, and he makes it out of, I believe it's Delrin, so it'll hold up really well outdoors. It comes in white, black, and I think like olive green, so it'll blend in, and it, you make your own, I believe it's 600 ohm line with this. You can buy a spool of line in the local home improvement store, and it literally, the wire literally snaps into the end of these brackets to hold it perfectly spaced. Fairly inexpensive, and it's a great way if he's looking to make his own open wire line. Dick, back to you.
Good comment again, 2MB.
Highly recognized, but I'm first going to go back to Rich. Rich, that sounds like a very nice product. Roughly, what is the cost of those things, if you happen to know, Rich? KTUPS, K2RAW.
I think to make about 100 feet of lateral line using this stuff would probably cost about maybe $30, $29 or so for the individual plastic pieces.
Yeah, they sound like they're very nicely constructed. It's a nice company. And two, Moon Bounce. back from his vacation. K2IW, go right ahead, Barry.
Okay, I wish I was still on it, and I will be soon, actually. Yeah, I think what I'm getting from this conversation is this is somewhat like a two-element beam. And I'm thinking that the one parameter that you probably can't really play around with would be the spacing between the two dipoles. Am I right about that? And 2MB.
Good guess, Barry, but the answer is absolutely not. There are people who have made the spacing between the two dipoles well under an eighth of a wavelength, properly fed, parasitically, or all fed, got all kinds of high performance out of it. There are people who have made the spacing as long as a half wavelength or beyond between the dipoles, and for their particular antenna, depending on how they feed it with the twin lead-like structure between the dipoles and where they connect the transmission line, they get high performance. So it's one of the big variables, because you would think the spacing creates the phase shift between the antenna dipoles. That's only one of the variables. Whether or not the individual dipoles are longer or shorter than resonant, making them highly inductive or highly capacitive, making them very big phase lagging devices or phase leading devices, is another big variable. So if you're smart enough and to juggling those variables, you are absolutely not fixed at a very narrow region of spacings. So there's a lot of variables that can be made to work here. Ain't that crazy, Barry? N2 Moonbounce, K2LIW in the TechNet.
It's also a little confusing. I'm not going to bring it up on the net tonight, but on a future net, I would like to bring that up because I don't agree with it. Okay, back to you, N2MB.
Common sense would lead you to believe you'd want something close to a quarter wavelength of spacing between the two dipoles, with a quarter wavelength of feeding to the two dipoles. If there are perfectly resonant dipoles, and that's going to give you the highest directivity accordioid pattern. That is true. That's just one of the possible embodiments. There are people who have made the spacing between dipoles extremely close, where the coupling between the two is huge, but by carefully adjusting the lengths and methods of feeding, they again can get a nearly perfect accordioid pattern with extremely close spacing. It's hard to believe, but as you approach nearly 180 degrees of phase shift between two dipoles that are very closely mounted, the coupling between the two is huge, but as long as you've got the right kind of feeding mechanism to compensate for all of that, you can get very high directivity at a very close spacing. It's opposite of common sense. I've seen articles on this where people have done it very successfully. A two-element Yagi can give you 6 1/2 dB of gain with very close spacing, a nearly cordioid pattern. And two moon dots, K2IW, go ahead, Barry.
Okay, that's confusing. If you say so, I'm starting to understand what you're telling me, but it still ain't sitting right. Okay, we'll get back to it later, N2MB.
I guarantee what's bothering you is bothering other people, so give me a couple of words on which portion of that discussion is hard for you to swallow. Wait for the beeps and go ahead, Barry.
I've been taught by you is that the spacing between the elements is directly proportional to the gain of the antenna. That is the one parameter I was told you can change the length of the elements, all kinds of things, but you can't change the spacing between them if you're going to get a certain amount of gain. That was what I was taught to believe, so I have to unbelieve that, which means maybe you could make a six-element beam the same way, which is even more confusing.
Okay, now I vaguely remember what I said, and it was a different application. If you and I are building a long Yagi with a very large number of directors, the spacing between the individual directors, you don't have a lot of variable there. Your spacing between the directors maybe averages 3/8 of a wavelength or 1/4 of a wavelength. because you're trying to synthesize a slow wave structure of this long string of directors, and you want the velocity factor of the signal flowing down that boom to have a particular velocity during that particular section of the boom. So that gives you a rather small amount of variance that you have on the spacing of those individual directors and the length of those directors. That is true, in my mind, for a long Yagi with a whole lot of directors. But if you're building a two-element Yagi, one driven element and one reflector, is the way it's usually done. Occasionally one driven element and one director.
How about three elements? Would that fall apart as three elements?
If I was building a three-element version, I might make the spacing between the driven element and the reflector super close, and then the director would have a significant spacing from that. Because I'm now trying to, the reflector super close is giving me a null in the back lobe, that's giving me the beginning of the cordioid pattern. But I'm still trying to simulate, I'm trying to emulate a slow wave structure out in front, and therefore you're going to have, for high performance, a reasonable spacing to that director. Could you make super close spacing with one reflector to the driven element, and super close spacing with one director to that driven element, and still give the whole thing high performance? There is my belief you've pushed the concept too far. So two elements can be super close. I don't think you can do it with three, because now your individual circulating currents and your coupling factors are going so high that you, even building them out of silver material, you're going to get a lot of resistive loss, and some of the real slow wave structure that gives you the Yagi phenomena is going to break down if you push that to three elements. I think the answer is no, but by way of computer modeling, you can confirm or deny that one now, Barry. N2 Moon Bounce, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, but you are standing by your argument. Two elements, yes, you can bring them super close, which opens up a Pandora's box of possibilities. That's amazing.
There have been one or two articles in QST Magazine over the last 10 years where somebody has done that. And for all I know, it may have also been in QEX, Experimenters Exchange, ARRL. So super close spacing of two elements can give you a lot of performance over a rather narrow bandwidth. You're not going to get a lot of bandwidth out of it. But as long as you've got very high conductivity materials carefully mounted so that the spacing between the two is not waving in the wind, and, you know, if you've got the two elements 3 inches apart and they're going to wave by 1.5 inches in the wind, you're going to get a whole lot of QSB due to the wind, if you know what I mean. You've got to be careful how you use this concept. But super close spacing of two elements can give a whole lot of performance over a narrow bandwidth. And that's another one of the crazy antennas that at first seem to violate good common sense. Okay. George is going to be reporting back to us periodically on this one. We've got Joe, RYY, Steve, HUC, and Freddie VBN in the windows right now, in the wings right now. I'm going to go to Joe next. W2RYY, K2RIW. How have those electrons and those antennas been treating you this week, Joe? You got it, Joe. K2RIW, the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. I thought HUC signed in before me. It's like a double or something like that. So put them in the right place if that's correct.
Okay. I didn't want to keep you too long because sometimes we've lost you in the past when we kept you too long. KD2HUC. Steve, if you like, I'll give you my quick impression of what I think your question is going to be. Stand by. In the case of quarter-wave ground plane vertically polarized antennas, properly built to give a whole lot of performance, and if you have the resources, you'd like to make a zillion ground plane radials of roughly a quarter wavelength at your favorite frequency in order for the RF energy not to see the Earth between those ground plane radials. And let me walk into this one slowly. In the case of the most prevalent antenna, basic element of all the antennas we build, a dipole is the most basic thing in the world. It's a standing wave structure. The RF energy you put into the dipole is going to bounce back and forth between the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the dipole at least 10 times before it finally gets radiated. The word resonance means that all those bounces stay co-phase, stay in step with each other. That's why you fight so hard for it to be electronically resonant. And electronically resonant means you've either made the length right, or you've added the right loading coils and top hat capacitors and zigzagging and antenna tuning in order to electronically force it into resonance. Let me drop. So once you accept that your dipole is electronically resonant at your favorite frequency, it's going to give you very high performance. 98% of the energy you put into the dipole is going to be radiated to space, but it takes at least 10 bounces for that to happen. At one inch in a time, the right side of the dipole is positive, the left side is negative. There's a neutral plane down the middle. You can put a sheet of metal at right angles to the dipole, right down the center. And when you put that sheet of metal there, infinitely big sheet of metal at right angles to the wire, it doesn't change the impedance, it doesn't change the pattern, it doesn't change the gain, it changes nothing. But once you admit you can put that sheet of metal there, you now realize that you can feed the right-hand side of the dipole with reference to that sheet of metal, and don't feed the left-hand side. Throw away the left-hand side. The left-hand side is there in the sheet of metal as a mirror image. And now when you feed sheet of metal and the right-hand side, you rotate the whole thing 90 degrees, lay it flat against the ground. That is your vertical ground plane antenna that we build. Notice that that sheet of metal would like to be an infinitely conducting sheet of metal that goes to infinity. Let me drop. Very few of us have those resources. And so they've made discoveries that if you put a number of quarter wave length ground plane radials, you do a pretty good job of simulating that infinite sheet of metal. And the individual rods, you would like them to be a quarter wave length long, so that they give you the maximum performance at your operating frequency. You could make them longer if you want to. And you would also like to have them close enough in spacing so that the RF energy cannot sneak in between the ground plane radios and see Earth, because Earth is a volumetric, resistive, lossy material. You'd like to have not too much of the RF energy go into that Earth and heat it up and keep the worms warm in the wintertime, because that's a waste of your RF energy. So putting down 32 radials is not unreasonable if you want very high performance. And making those radios a crisscross grid, a number of people have done that. Broadcast stations do that. And there's good reason for doing that. Let me drop. Now, in the case of my 80-meter dipole made out of 14-gauge wire, hung up 40 feet in the air, when I'm doing that construction, one of the questions frequently asked is, hey, my 14-gauge wire starts off with rubber insulation. Would I be better off leaving the rubber insulation on or taking it off? Leaving on the rubber insulation gives you a little bit more weight, a little bit more wind resistance, but a little bit less copper oxide because you're giving some weather protection of the wire. RF-wise, the rubber has almost no effect. Yes, if you leave the rubber on when you're building a cubical quad Yagi, the rubber does add some extra capacitance and slightly changes the tuning frequency. But in the case of an 80-meter flat-out dipole or inverted D, electrically the RF energy goes through the rubber till it hits the copper and does its thing. And whether the rubber is there or not, electronically makes no difference on an 80-meter dipole. So some people will leave the rubber on, tolerate the extra weight and extra wind resistance in order to give a little bit more longevity of their copper wire. By the same token, your ground plane radials, should they be insulated from the Earth, that's an extremely minor factor. The majority of the work of those ground plane radios, let me drop, is the fact that they are a metal conductor, just like that 80-meter dipole in the air. The RF energy goes through that rubber and sees the metal and does its thing. And insulating the wire from the Earth nearby, very, very minor factor. You put your ohmmeter on your wire of your ground plane radio, one lead, and the other lead, you put it 2 inches away and touch the Earth on a dry day, and you'll see that you've got an extremely high impedance. So the Earth itself, nearby to the wire, is a very high impedance. And whether you leave the rubber insulation on the ground plane radials is a very minor factor, RF-wise. There is some benefit as far as the rate of deterioration of your ground plane radials if you're making them out of materials where the ground will eat into them. So It's your choice, and you're not going to... If you tried to measure the electrical performance of laying down 16 ground plane radios with rubber...